Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Classic FM. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, country, rock, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the websites Britannica.com and SouthernLiving.com. Question number one, when was the clarinet first invented? Was that A, around the 6th century? Is it B, around 1500? Was it C, in the 18th century? Or was it D, around 1905? The clarinet, when was its debut? And question number two, which place in the USA is known as the Big Easy? Was that A, New York City, New York? B, New Orleans, Louisiana? Was it C, Hollywood, California? D, Miami, Florida? Or E, Memphis, Tennessee? The Big Easy, from Where Art Thou Anyway? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of June the 2nd. Well, it was on this very day back in 1857 that composer Sir Edward William Elgar was born. Elgar was known for such compositions as Pomp and Circumstance, appropriate for this time of year. Elgar's B-Day today in 1857. And it was 56 years ago today, 1967, that in the U.S., Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was released by the Beatles. It was released on June the 1st in the U.K. and around the world. Sgt. Pepper's today in the USA in 1967. And in country music news, we have this article titled American Idol Shocker. E.M. Tongi beats country crooners to win season 21 intense finale. Published in USAtoday.com on the 22nd of May, 2023, and written by Charles Trapani. American Idol Season 21 delivered yet another shock during its tense finale. Sunday's three-hour broadcast, which aired live on ABC Coast to Coast, saw the final three contestants, Megan Danielle, Colin Stow, and E.M. Tongi, each take the stage for the last time to win votes from viewers. Judges Katy Perry, Luke Bryan, and Lionel Richie provided feedback as usual. But in this last leg of the competition, all they could offer was praise and good wishes as the singers leave the show to embark on their music careers. On American Idol, it's become somewhat standard for rugged country crooners to sweep the competition to victory, as Noah Thompson did last year and Chase Beckham the year before. That's why the studio audience let out a collective gasp when host Seacrest announced that, after the nationwide vote, Staff was eliminated, leaving Tongi and Danielle to face off as finalists. The 18-year-old high schooler returned to perform Cool Down by Kaloi Kai as a dedication to his hometown of Kahuku, Hawaii. "Yum, you are the culture," Katy Perry said after the touching performance. "Welcome to paradise, my friend." After the final commercial break, the votes were locked in and Seacrest revealed the winner. It was Tongi. He sang Spawn Breezes, Don't Let Go, as his fellow contestants rushed the stage and confetti rained down. He's the first non-country singer to win the show in 3 years. Haydn's Emperor's Hymn from String Quartet in C introduces our classical music news. It's titled, Why Don't Chamber Orchestras Get Their Due? This is published in BBC Music Magazine, 30th of May, 2023. When people talk about the greatest orchestras in the world, it's usually the same candidates. The Berlin Philharmonic, Vienna Philharmonic, London Symphony, Cleveland Orchestra, and the rest. But it's the same kind of candidates, meaning full, big-sound symphony orchestras. Chamber orchestras, those smaller and more nimble ensembles, that tend to number up to about 40 musicians compared to their big siblings, 100-plus, rarely get a look in, even the best of them. And as a conductor who has spent much of his career standing in front of the world's leading chamber orchestras, I can say with certainty that the best of them are the best of the best. Let's start why chamber orchestras don't get their due. Promoters, often the media and concertgoers as well, have the mindset that size matters, and even the music colleges don't prioritize chamber orchestras. What is the most popular repertoire? Huge symphonies by Mahler and Shostakovich. Beethoven played with a big sound. Everything is quote-unquote epic or quote-unquote spectacular. It's not surprising if you consider what's happened in the history of music. As cities built large halls and threw resources at them, composers had free rein. In Europe, for instance, there were the spa towns that demanded cultural activities for their leisure clientele, like Baden-Baden in Austria, which invited Berlioz to run its music festival and encouraged him to write big pieces for big concerts, no expense spared. What Berlioz and a few others got, all the composers started to demand. Fast forward to the late 20th century and up to today, and we've had decades of film composers like John Williams and Hans Zimmer, themselves influenced by the enormous musical palettes of Mahler, Bruckner, and Prokofiev. And so audiences and promoters alike are trained to expect that bigger is better. But it was not always that way. Brahms' orchestra was small, with only 8 or 10 first violins. Mozart, Mendelssohn, Schumann, and so many great composers wrote for these small, compact groups. I'm not saying that symphony orchestras aren't vital, and I conduct many of them and love doing so. And there are things you can achieve with more musicians in terms of texture, color, and scope that are important. But when you have a smaller group of musicians, a chamber orchestra, every musician is like a soloist. You can hear all of them individually. Every single one counts and counts a lot. That makes enormous demands on each musician and requires a lot of intensive preparation. And then, beyond all of that, every musician must articulate in the same way, almost breathing as one. Everything in a chamber orchestra is so transparent and clear. Every detail tells, and any technical mistake and even lapse in style is completely exposed. So you can stop and spend 5 minutes working on one single bar, on the intonation, on the phrasing. You can't do that in the same way with a big symphony orchestra, because between all that massive sound, you simply can't hear the same level of detail. And here's another truth. Listening to a huge sound is, well, easier. You can sit back and it washes over you, and that in itself is an impressive thing. Chamber orchestras, without that advantage, have to work harder to make the audience sit forward and, as it were, come to them. And the best chamber orchestras work harder than you would believe to make that happen. But the rewards, when it all works, are indescribable. And now there's a chance for audiences to discover chamber orchestras anew. After the pandemic, we saw many promoters wanting to program famous composers to tempt audiences back, but with smaller works to keep costs down. Famous symphonies by Beethoven and Mozart, for instance, the natural ground for chamber orchestras. And just as the symphony orchestras play works created for smaller groups, which is fine, it also became acceptable to adapt larger works for chamber orchestras. Tina Turner's What's Love Got to Do With It introduces our R&B music news. It's titled Opinion, Life Lessons from Tina Turner. This is written by Scott Simon and published in NPR.org on the 27th of May, 2023. By the time Tina Turner released their hit song, What's Love Got to Do With It, in 1984, she had already seen her career rise and fall. The song had been written by two British guys, Terry Britton and Graham Lyle, who offered it to Cliff Richard, the Brit rock and roller who turned it down. A few more singers, including Donna Summer, reportedly considered it for a while. Maybe they found the lyrics a little hard to put across. What's love got to do with it? Got to do with it? Seems to ask, am I feeling love or something dangerous? Will I just get hurt again? What does love actually do for anyone anyway? As it's so piercingly phrased and left to hang in our minds, who needs a heart when a heart can be broken? By this time, Tina Turner was 44 years old. She had been playing gigs on what used to be known as a quote-unquote nostalgia circuit, where she sang old hits in casinos and county fairs. What you hear in her voice in What's Love Got to Do With It is the hard rock of what she'd lived through, growing up in the cotton fields of Nutbush, Tennessee, singing in a church choir, and later in nightclubs, and working as a nurse's aide. She got a job singing backup for Ike Turner, then became his co-star, married him in Tijuana, and after years of abuse, escaped him in Dallas, bruised and bloodied, with just 36 cents and a gas card in her pocket. It scares me to feel this way, she sings in a voice that's rugged, raw, and raspy, as if being pulled phrase by phrase and still warm straight from her heart. You hear her hurt and weariness, and she asks, what's love but a second-hand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Won 3 Grammys and marked one of the great comebacks of music history. By the time she died this week, at the age of 83, Tina Turner had a happy second marriage to a German music executive named Erwin Bach and lived in France and Switzerland. She received a Kennedy Center honor and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice. Tina Turner once told an interviewer, "People think my life has been tough, but I think it's been a wonderful journey. The older you get, the more you realize it's not what happened. It's how you deal with it. Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken again and again?" Tina Turner moved us to raise our hands and open our hearts, even when it hurts.
Well, I am just a poor boy, though my story sounds tall. I've squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such old promises.
Paul Simon's The Boxer introduces our music research article. It's titled, "Simon Says He Lost Hearing in Left Ear While Working on Album." This is written by Emily St. Martin, published in the L.A. Times and the News and Observer on the 28th of May, 2023. Paul Simon has revealed that he has lost most of the hearing in his left ear. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame musician opened up about mysteriously losing his hearing in his left ear during an interview with the Times of the U.K. The Grammy-winning singer-songwriter who penned many of American folk duo Simon and Garfunkel's biggest hits, including The Sound of Silence and Bridge Over Troubled Water, said his hearing loss happened quite suddenly. "Nobody has an explanation for it," Simon says, "so everything became more difficult." His hearing went as he was busy writing the music for the new album, Seven Psalms, which dropped this month. The San Diego Union-Tribune described it as a seven-song collection that revels in melancholic understatement and gentle nuances, exploring themes of mortality and spirituality, joy and dread, the past and present, the unknown future, and a clock that, for this 81-year-old music legend, in the autumn of his years, ticks louder each day. Simon said that losing his hearing initially left him frustrated and annoyed, but not angry, because I thought it would pass, it would repair itself. But that hasn't happened, which means he may have to rule out live performances. He doesn't necessarily consider that a bad thing. The reality of aging seems to be at the forefront of the Graceland singer's mind. He mentioned the passing of folk legend Gordon Lightfoot and Yardbirds guitarist Jeff Beck, saying, "My generation's time is up." So, how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, when was the clarinet first invented? Was that A, around the 6th century? Was it B, around 1500? Was it C, in the 18th century, or D, around 1905? Correct answer? Answer C, in the 18th century. As noted in Britannica.com, the invention of the clarinet was in the early 18th century by Johann Christoph Denner, a renowned woodwind maker in Nuremberg. Previously, single reeds were used only in organs and folk instruments. The clarinet's immediate predecessor was the small mock trumpet, or chalumeau, an adaptation of a folk reed pipe that Denner is credited with improving. The modern clarinet was developed between 1800 and 1850. An article in a 2019 ThoughtCo.com adds, "The soprano clarinet is one of the most versatile instruments in modern musical performance, and parts of it are included in classical orchestral pieces, orchestra band compositions, and jazz pieces. It is made in several different keys, including B-flat, E-flat, and A, and it is not uncommon for large orchestras to have all three. It is even sometimes heard in rock music, Sly and the Family Stone, The Beatles, Pink Floyd, Aerosmith, Tom Waits, and Radiohead are just some of the acts that have included the clarinet in recordings. The modern clarinet entered its most famous period during the big band jazz era of the 1940s. Eventually, the mellower sound and easier fingering of the saxophone replaced the clarinet in some compositions, but even today, many jazz bands feature at least one clarinet. And the answer to our second question, which place in the U.S. is known as, quote-unquote, the Big Easy? Is that A, New York City, New York? Is it B, New Orleans, Louisiana? Is it C, Hollywood, California? Is it D, Miami, Florida? Or E, Memphis, Tennessee? Correct answer? Answer B, New Orleans, Louisiana. As noted in an article titled, Why is New Orleans Called the Big Easy? The story behind the city by Perry Ormont Blumber in SouthernLiving.com on May the 16th, 2023. NOLA, Crescent City, New Orleans. There's no shortage of ways to refer to the Louisiana city we adore, perched on the Mississippi River in Lake Pontchartrain. But how did it get that ever-popular tag, the Big Easy? From film and literature to Prohibition culture, there are many theories why the Big Easy has become one of the many nicknames attributed to New Orleans. While the true origin of the moniker may never be clear, here are a few reasons why. The Big Easy has continued to thrive as a New Orleans nickname. There's Easy Dance Hall. The Big Easy Hall in Gretna, Louisiana, is one of the more popular theories for a New Orleans nickname. In 1911, the African American Dance Club was where legendary cornet player Buddy Bolden occasionally performed, solidifying the region as an emerging and thriving jazz music city. Then there's the easy prohibition regulation. New Orleans' relaxed adherence to prohibition restrictions between 1920 and 1933 fueled the use of this friendly nickname. New Orleanians continued to display an active social and nightlife during this time, including enjoying everything from bathtub gins to the finest wines. Then there's the easy-paced living theory. While New Yorkers were perpetually running around in the Big Apple, laid-back life in New Orleans reigned, hence the Big Easy. World Atlas states that a New Orleans gossip columnist coined the phrase in the late 1960s. Early jazz roots in New Orleans contributed to its easygoing, music-filled culture and bustling music scene. The National Park Service states the purposes of social and pleasure clubs were to provide a social outlet for its members, provide community service, and parade as an expression of community pride. And then there's the easy book and film theory. In 1970, James Conway's crime novel, The Big Easy, created the ubiquitous association of the book's title and New Orleans. Conway overheard a group of African-American men use the phrase, The Big Easy, according to WorldAtlas.com, later becoming the title for his book. The Big Easy was used again for the 1986 film adaptation and helped paint a dramatized picture of New Orleans that was previously unknown. It's starting to look like this New Orleans nickname etymology may be as contentious as who fries up the best beignet in town. A 23 issue of GoodHousekeeping.com in February adds these little-known facts about the Big Easy and its annual Mardi Gras carnival celebration. The word carnival comes from Latin, carne, veil, which means farewell to meat. Carnival celebrations originated in Nice, France, with the earliest records dating back to 1294. Mardi Gras became a holiday in 1582 when Pope Gregory XIII added it to the Gregorian calendar. The Lemoyne brothers brought the Mardi Gras celebration to the U.S. when they were sent by King Louis XIV to defend France's claim on the Louisiana Territory in 1699. Fat Tuesday was declared a state holiday in Louisiana in 1875, about 150 years ago. Places like Ireland, England, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada refer to Mardi Gras as Shrove Tuesday. Shrove is rooted in the word shrive, which means to absolve, and people often go to church to confess their sins. The crew of Rex also selected the theme song, If Ever I Cease to Love, which has since been adopted as the anthem for Mardi Gras. Purple, gold, and green are the official Mardi Gras colors. They were selected by Rex crew to honor visiting Russian Grand Duke Alexis Romanov because they were his family colors. The masks are worn to allow people to escape society and class constraints. It is required by law for people on floats to be wearing masks. The first Mardi Gras parade in New Orleans was held in 1837. The term Mardi Gras only refers to the final day, also known as Fat Tuesday. This year, Mardi Gras fell on Tuesday, February the 21st. So let's close out today's program with New Orleans' own Pete Fountains, Just a Closer Walk with Thee. Clarinetist Fountain, who passed away in 2016, was founder and the most prominent member of the Half Fast Walking Club, one of the best-known freelance marching units that parade in New Orleans on Mardi Gras Day. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. Now, as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information, or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long. Until next time.